Good morning. Well, it wasn't entirely unexpected, but a bit disappointing nevertheless. The COVID-19 reproduction rate is up, and phase 4 of the reopening is paused or reset. July 20th has now become August 10th. All going well. On Thursday's News at One, science correspondent George Lee talked us through the numbers.
5-day average number of cases at the peak was 559. Cases per day. That's adjusted to when they actually were effective, when people were infected. That fell then quite sharply by the end of May to 60 and by the early June to 52. But by the middle of June, it was 17 per day. The following week, 19 per day. It was 9 per day by the 24th of June. 1st of July, 13. So it's beginning to creep a little bit up, but not alarmingly. Mm-hmm. Then 14 and now 22 most recently. Yeah. So that's what they were looking at. And they're looking at that being a significant increase. It's of the order of 56-57% in terms of the incidence, but from a very low base. So that's number one thing for people not to panic when they see that. But the number two thing is to be reassured that you have the National Public Health Emergency Team watching it like hawks, and the government actually listening to them and saying this is something that you need to worry about. And now they're saying it is possibly up to 1.8 today, between 1.2 and 1.8, which is an average of 1.5. We're at that point. So if they did nothing, we would end up having the restrictions which were lifted being reimposed, and that could be very, very damaging to the economy and everybody else. And you would not get to the situation in the middle of August where you would have low numbers and could look forward to schools opening, and that would be a nightmare.
Well, yesterday, Sarah McInerney spoke to Dr. Killian de Gascoigne, director of the National Virus Reference Laboratory, and asked this of the reproduction rate.
If it is at 1.8 today, is it too late to stop it?
So it's too late to impact on, say, the case numbers that we would report over the next 7 to 10 days. Those infections have already occurred, so the die is cast ready for next week. But it's really important that people appreciate that they can have an effect on what happens 2 and 3 weeks from now, because those infections haven't yet occurred. We know that with small numbers of cases, the R naught can be variable. We also know that it can be very difficult to get an accurate reflection on it. So we don't want people to think that this is an unmitigated disaster and that they've, you know, somehow done something wrong. We know that as we opened up society, so we came through May 18th, then June 8th, and things were good. We opened up. It was likely we would see more cases, but we didn't see the R naught rise dramatically. And then obviously we came to June 29th. And I suppose what's possibly concerning over the last week or so is that the increase that Professor Philip Nolan would have talked about, that probably started at the end of June, so before the impact of the 29th of June. So that's where our concern lies. So the case numbers started to rise
before the pubs were open, for example.
Before the restaurants, yeah, exactly. Before the restaurants opened, and before we sort of broadened out society more widely, or opened up society more widely. So that's why we're concerned. But it is just concern at this stage. As I said, the numbers are still low, and we know that the R naught can be impacted by sort of a couple of large clusters. And I think we have a very good handle on where these infections have occurred over the last week. So it's not as if cases are popping up completely unpredictably all over the country.
Okay. Well, we're all awake and alert now, and maybe ever so slightly anxious. Would a little drink take the edge off? A little bit early, in fairness. But if you do want a pint, the pubs are still closed. Unless, of course, you wangle a slice of pizza or the side of curly fries. Ryan Turberty feels your pain, but he's putting on the kilt.
It's 3 weeks. And I know it's 3 weeks on top of all the other weeks and months. I get it. And do you know what I was thinking this morning? Braveheart. We are at a Braveheart moment. And I feel that we collectively have to put the hand out and just go, hold, hold, hold. If you can scratch together the €9, go down and have some chicken nuggets and chips to go with your pints. But just hold, because we're going to get there, lads. Honest to goodness.
And we can live without the pub for another wee bit. Very doable. Not a whole lot of crack, mind you, but doable. However, for publicans without a restaurant licence or the means to serve food, this is an extremely difficult situation. Kate and her brother run a pub outside Clonmel, and she spoke to Katie Hannan on Thursday's Liveline.
My brother, for example, he's over 66, so he doesn't get a COVID payment. So except for a small pension that is taxed, he's got no income coming in since last March. You know, it is just I mean, when I rang him and told him yesterday, because I heard it on the Mary Wilson show first, he actually cried. You know, a man of 67 years of age, you know, and I'm actually near at that stage now myself, you know.
Yeah. Take a breath there, Kate.
It's really difficult. I mean, that pup has been in our family for, I think, 5 generations. And we want to keep it going. You know, not for just ourselves, but because the regulars coming in, you know, that we call friends, is such a blow to everybody. It really is. And I'm sure I'm not alone in this.
I'm sure you're not, Kate. I'm sure you're not. And did you really think, because there was certainly kind of the indications over the last few days that the public health advice was not going to support reopening pubs.
Yeah. So yeah, it didn't surprise me, I'll be honest with you. But we still went ahead and, you know, we're trying to get everything in order. Now, I've been in a couple of places, food-wise. You go up to the counter and pay, and there's no Perspex, no nothing, you know. Whereas there we, a small little, you know, shebeen. And I'm trying to get everything in order. And there's a lot of money gone out on it. And nothing coming in.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking.
You know, it is absolutely heartbreaking.
Oh, a very difficult situation, in fairness. That was Kate with Katie Hannon on Liveline. And another COVID-y issue that got phone lines lighting up and fingers at the text machine was tourists and visitors flying in from abroad. Gave Minifalcha on a bit of a hold, it seems. A woman in a quandary was journalist Mary Kenny. She had been invited to give a talk at the Percy French Festival in Roscommon next week. But should she quarantine for 14 days? Well, she spoke to Sarah McInerney on Monday.
And because a lot of talk about how essential travel, that's what the government is saying, please avoid non-essential travel. That's for leaving the country. But I would you see this as essential travel to come to a talk in a festival in Roscommon?
Well, I thought it was a commitment that I made. And whenever I've been invited to do a talk or to give a talk, to give a lecture, I've always met my commitment, you know, and I do think it's very important to try to fulfil engagements that you've agreed to. People have booked, people have paid tickets and so on. This isn't a travel just to see the countryside, you know, for fun. Though I love to see the countryside, it's a professional engagement.
Lots of people have cancelled professional engagements though over the last couple of months because of this situation.
Well, I think that's been overdone myself personally, and people are cancelling things right up into the autumn and so on.
Well, what do you think is overdone about it? I mean, we know travel spreads this disease. We know people meeting each other from different countries can spread the disease. You know, that there's different situations of COVID-19, much more risky situations indeed in Britain than there is in Ireland at the moment. Is it overdone to say, please don't come from Britain right now without quarantining for 14 days?
Look, I just think there are many, many different approaches to all this, and different countries have taken different approaches, things will change, I presume, as time goes by and more of us have immunity and so on. But I don't, you know, I don't think this is the Black Death, Sarah. You know, it is an unpleasant flu-like illness which kills some people who are very vulnerable. I just think that we should be proportionate in our responses to the risks of life, which happen all the time.
But texters into Sarah weren't exactly laying out the red carpet for Mary.
One person says, Sarah, my blood is boiling listening to Mary Kenny. We will be back in lockdown in no time. Wake up. Mandatory quarantine for all arrivals is an absolute must. That's coming from Lisa. Another person says, has Mary seen the recent Primetime Investigates programme? This is about safeguarding people's lives. Is that not good enough reason to give interview via Zoom? Another person says, what medical school did Dr. Mary Kenny go to again? Another person says, so Mary Kenny thinks we should drop the regulations for her. Another says, always liked Mary Kenny, but she has lost me forever now. What nonsense.
Nonsense or no, Mary Kenny has since decided not to attend the festival. But when Simon Harris, Minister for Further and Higher Education, spoke to Mary Wilson on Thursday's Drive Time, there did seem to be shifting goalposts as to what was expected of our visitors.
I'm not sure if there's been a change in what we're asking people to do when they come into the country now. Is it to self-isolate or to just restrict their movements?
Sorry, it's to restrict movements, absolutely. So NEF has changed its position on that, or nuanced its position on this a couple of weeks ago. So it's now to restrict your movements. I don't think we were aware of that, Minister.
I noticed it today when the Tánaiste used it for, as far as I know, the first time.
Yes, certainly I'm aware of it. No, I think that was announced by NEF some time ago, but I'm open to correction on that. But
the message remains the same. There's a big difference between restricting your movements and quarantining.
There's a subtle difference, though, between restricting your movements and self-isolating. So self-isolating is stay at home, stay in the room, don't leave the room, don't mix with anyone else from the house. Restricting your movement can recognise the fact that you might need to pop out for a litre of milk, you might need to pick up medication in the pharmacy. It doesn't in any way suggest that you should be doing anything other than keeping yourself to yourself.
I wouldn't say it's subtle at all. I think it's a great big difference.
Well, let me be very, very clear. And I know I'm now a former health minister, but my understanding in relation to this is crystal clear. And again, a government last night was crystal clear. If you come into our country, wherever you come from, whether you're Irish returning or not, the requirement at the moment to keep yourself to yourself, stay at home, not go to work, not mix, is very, very much there. It's very, very important that is there.
But the word quarantine is gone. You're not saying to people when you come into Ireland you must quarantine for 14 days. You're saying to them now, restrict your movements.
That's right.
That is a significant change, Minister.
Well, I don't believe it is, quite truthfully. But and let me not cause any confusion at all in relation to this situation. I mean, anybody who comes in from our country is meant to very much restrict their movements, is meant restrict to stay
them.
At home.
Back to Sarah with Dr. Killian de Gascoigne yesterday, and she picked up on this point.
Looking through the minutes of NEFIT over the last couple of months, it's quite clear that what NEFIT has actually advised the government and what its preference would be for mandatory quarantine. Yes? Mandatory quarantine for 14 days is what NEFIT advised the government back in May and has continued to advise the government on a regular basis over the last couple of months. Restriction of non-essential travel from all other EU countries, a mandatory regime of self-isolation at a designated facility for all persons arriving into Ireland from overseas. At a designated facility now, don't just go to your holiday home in Clare and self-isolate mandatorily for 14 days. That's what the government was told back in May. They were told it again on June 11th. They were told it again on June 25th. And indeed, the language on June 25th in the NEFIT meetings says, NEFIT reiterates the urgency, its prior recommendations on the need for legal restrictions to be put in place with regard to overseas travel. Now, that was 2 weeks ago, before we started getting the texts about the American travellers.
Yeah, no, I think NEFIT has been consistent on this since May. And I think that's the public health advice. Obviously, government takes that advice and needs to consider all of the other factors that contribute to it. And there's been a number of suggestions that sort of the legal framework around that will be challenging. But you're right, that's been the public health advice since May.
And then she put this to him.
Are you not worried? Because that makes me worried that we're having people coming here and the clear public health advice from the experts sitting around and discussing this and looking at all the international evidence is put people in a mandatory quarantine. And the government has been consistently ignoring it and is continuing to ignore it even as we're getting international travellers. Does that not make you worried?
I don't envy the task the government has, because obviously our economy has taken a huge shock over the last 5 months. Sure. So they have to consider a huge amount of factors. From a public health perspective, we're in some respects, we're fortunate that we've a single issue to look at. And we have looked at that, and in our opinion, the best approach to this is that you would, because in order for people, we've asked people not to come to Ireland, we're advising them not to travel here. But you're right, if there's no overt disincentive when they arrive at the airport, then we're probably not discouraging them sufficiently.
Dr. Killian de Gascoigne with Sarah yesterday, but one twiddle of the dial to Liveline back on Monday would leave the Yankee Doodle Dandies in no doubt as to the very definite lack of, oh, you're very welcome, sir, if they were to land in Shannon. Here's Audrey.
I look up the flights coming in from America, and I think, why the hell did I cocoon for so long when the government, and I'm blaming the government 100% on this, that they should actually stop those flights.
So, no Yanks are their Yankee dollars welcome here. No sneaky afternoon pints, no sweaty dancing. And as for the melee to catch the bouquet at the wedding, are you mad? However, there was one small ray of light in the week. There's a new star sign in town.
Ophiuchus.
I'm sorry, pardon?
Ophiuchus.
Yes, if you were born between November 29th and December 17th, listen up, because this is you.
You are a very complicated character who wants success, not just for yourself, but for everyone else in your life. You can be a super strong lover once your emotions are fully evolved. You're passionate and not interested in short-term relationships. You are flamboyant and expect people to be in awe of you and notice your presence. Ophiuchus. There you go.
And Darcy, never a man to shy away from a bit of existential angst. We had the sourdough. Oh my God, we had the sourdough. And now, the big question. Just who am I?
So everybody, like, that means that I'm a Leo now. I used to be a Virgo and I thought I was living up to the whole Virgo thing, being, you know, a perfectionist and liking everything in its place and routine and all that sort of thing. And now I'm a Leo. What's it? Leo is ruled by the sun, which unsurprisingly means Leo are passionate and enthusiastic people, gravitating towards leadership roles. Leos are ambitious and often have vivacious personalities. Never been described as having a vivacious personality. Mystic Meg says, you are passionate, playful, and when you know you're loved, can be tender and loyal.
Oh, gosh. A total rewiring of the brain there. That was Ray, the reluctant Leo. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Difference and exclusion cropped up a lot on the airwaves this week. On Culturefile over on Lyric, Dr. Zelia Asava talked to Finn Keegan about black and mixed race Irish on screen, and in particular in the horror genre.
In 2005, you have Isolation and Boyd's Girl, which emerge as two horror films with mixed race leads, symbols of the new Ireland and a new tolerance and a new understanding of Irishness, but also mixedness as monstrosity and the kind of contradictory relationship that we have with racial others in this country, where we're both excited by the other but also afraid in some way of losing a sense of what it means to be Irish. And you have Ruth Negger in Isolation, who's talked about the difficulty of casting agents in America understanding her as an Irish woman, because they assume that to be Irish you have to be pale skin, to have freckles, red hair. You know, the 1950s stereotype is still very popular, but these young women who are becoming, certainly in the case of Negger, becoming a kind of, again, a globally recognisable face, the new face of Ireland, the face of the new Ireland, if you like.
Dr. Zelia Zava on Culturefile. And being mixed race and Irish cropped up on Pantisocracy when musician Jess Kavanagh joined Panty.
Your mother, so she was
half Nigerian. Yeah.
And she died
in 2006. Oh. I was 20.
And around that time, you were in a sense exploring that part of your identity.
Very much so.
And there's a lovely thing about you trying to get your mother to go and get her hair braided.
That's right. So it's very bittersweet for me, because now we're looking at a Dublin and an Ireland that's very different. That's a lot more multicultural. We have a very strong black community and people of colour. And, you know, my mom was beginning to start to get a bit like, I might get some dreads, you know. And we were like, yeah, mom, do it. Let's get you some dreads. You know what I mean? And she was thinking about doing things that were kind of embracing her ethnicity. And we were really, really encouraging that. And then the knock-on effect is that I was very much embracing my ethnicity, but as a white passing mixed race person, that was kind of treated a lot differently. That was like, oh, you're showing off. And it's like, well, no, I'm not showing off. You're kind of showing that you see blackness as a commodity. So that's your problem. You know what I mean? Like, this is me embracing the fact that I am, you know, a person of color, that my mother is mixed race, that my grandfather is Nigerian, and I'm proud of that lineage. Mm. And it's very much in the music, and it's that I write. And I hope in the way that I carry myself and the communities that I navigate within.
But was that you were consciously exploring that part of your identity, or it just sort of happened through the music?
It was a mix of both, for sure. What I would have gotten growing up, when I started in the industry, I would have had people come up to me after a gig and say, do you realise that you sound like a And they'd never, and it would, and they'd always go down in volume when they get to that bit. You sound like a black person. And I'd kind of look at them and I'd be like, you know, sweaty and just off stage. I'd be like, yeah, my mom's black. And then they'd kind of laugh and they wouldn't know if it was a joke or not.
Yeah.
And then I'd, you know, very quickly try and leave Like, but it was a relatively regular thing that I would have gotten. I've definitely found as I've gotten older, I have created my community of people who are close to me, and I have a lot more people of colour in my life, a lot more queer black people in my life, and that has allowed me to navigate those spaces in a way where I feel safer and more myself, for sure.
Jess Kavanagh on Pantasocracy. And this week marked Traveller Pride Week, and on Liveline, Katie Hannon spoke to David Friel up in Donegal.
You were saying from, you know, very young age, you were wondering, why are you being called a gypsy or a knacker or, you know, some other slur like that. Yeah. Did it get easier? Did you as if your family become more integrated into the settled community where you were there? And did you kind of park your traveller identity to some degree as you went through school?
Definitely. I think, you know, sometimes as a member of the traveller community, and I have family and I have friends, I know other members of the traveller community that unfortunately, in the midst of Traveller Pride Week, have to feel like they have to hide their identity to gain employment, to gain educational opportunities perhaps, or just to integrate into the community. So I think there's still a sense of forced assimilation going on in terms of travellers feeling that they have to assimilate, like the settler community, to be accepted, which is totally not right. It's not good for mental health, the mental health of the community, and as we know, the mental health disproportionately affects the traveller community. But over time, you do start to build relationships, you start to build trust, and you build solidarity with some settled people. Not all Irish people are racist.
David with Katie Hannon on Liveline. On Keywords last night, Zoe Cummins was guided by the keyword light. And sometimes the most innocuous of actions can provoke some of the most interesting art.
A few years ago, I had a chat with artist Martin Creed. He won the Turner Prize in 2001 with his work Lights Going On and Off.
With the lights going on and off, it's a very kind of bare work.
It was as simple as it sounds. Imagine an empty room which is filled with light for 5 seconds, then plunged into darkness for 5 seconds more. And this repeats again and again.
It's like a relief to be in this big room where, you know, everything's just flashing on and off. It's like a relief from kind of having to look at things. You can look at anything you want, the ceiling, the people, it's all going on and off, you know.
Some people were outraged and felt it was a joke.
I mean, I don't know what the lights going on and off is about, you know, like any more than anyone else. So if someone thinks it's a waste of time, well, I mean, for them, then it obviously is, but I don't know.
Others thought it was genius, provocative, profound. But what I remember from our conversation is one of the inspirations he gave for his work.
I was thinking recently about the lights going on and off. When I was a kid, I used to love, like, when people were in the toilet. And you know how in toilets often the light switch is outside the room, and so, you know, you could switch the lights on and off and someone was in the toilet. You know, and so it's like being naughty and kind of doing what you're not supposed to do.
I like that idea that one of the most important modern works of art has a good deal of mischief behind it.
Oh, that is quite brilliant. That was artist Martin Creed with Zoe Cummins on Keywords. On Tuesday, Ray Darcy spoke to Rachel Gorry, whose husband Daniel died on April 1st at the age of 29. Theirs was the cutest of love stories. She'd met her husband at the age of 12 when he knocked on her door and asked her out to play. They started dating when they were 16, got married at 21, and they had three young girls before Daniel was diagnosed with esophageal cancer.
I've spoken to loads of people over the years about when they hear that word, you know, when you're in a room and somebody says that somebody you love has cancer.
Yeah. Oh, it's like being hit by a truck. I can't describe it. You know, we went in and you don't really know the questions to ask when you go in. You know, I'm a little bit naive in that sense. And I asked the professor, is it treatable? What I meant was curable. I meant, was he going to die? And I said treatable though, and he said, oh yeah, it's treatable, and we'll give you a treatment and come up tomorrow and we'll give you your plan. So we were obviously devastated that he had cancer, but on the way home I remember saying to his man, Dad, and to Daniel, like, I know it's terrible you have cancer, but you know, you're going to be okay.
It's treatable. You hung on to that word.
We went up the next day and Daniel's man, Dad, didn't come with us because they said, sure, there's no point to just giving you a treatment plan. And we went up and sat down and she just said, right, do you want us to be brutally honest? And we said, yeah, absolutely. So she said, look, you have stage 4 cancer. She said, you will have max 5 years to live. This will kill you. And we literally, I just, he just looked at her, and I just, the tears were just trickling down my face. But you know, and you just feel like, I couldn't believe what she was saying, and he was rubbing my leg, and he was like, it's going to be okay. And I just can't describe it. And then she just gave us a page and said, can you go down and get bloods there? And it was just so normal, you know, and yeah, she was just after ripping her whole world apart, and it was absolutely horrific.
And Rachel talked about the final moments of Daniel's life.
I wouldn't leave his side, not for a minute. I would literally, he'd fall asleep and I would run into the shower and have the quickest shower just to get back and sit by his bed. I didn't want to miss a second. And Daniel actually asked me the day he passed, he said, am I going to die today? And I said, no, you're not going to die today. And he said, when am I going to die? And I said, you're going to die soon. And he said, okay. And he died that morning. And I was in the chair beside his bed. And Daniel said, he was calling out for the kids, you know, he was hallucinating, so he'd always kind of shout stuff out. So he shouted out three girls' names, and he was like, come here, come here, come here. So I went over to him, he was like, Rachel, come here. So I went over, and he was like, do you want to go again? He used to always say that to me about having a fourth baby, because he would love a boy. And he was like, will we go again? And I said, will we go again? Will you stop? So he took to laugh, and he lay back down, and he passed away 20 minutes later.
So that was the last thing he said to you?
That was the last thing he said, yeah.
Will we go again?
Will we go again, yeah.
Oh, that's sort of lovely, isn't it?
It is lovely, yeah. It really is. He just, and just goes to show the sense of humour that he had, you know. He just kept me laughing.
Yeah.
The whole way.
Right to the end.
But the hardest moment was to come when Rachel had to break the news to their children.
How do you communicate all this now to the three girls? That's a big task, isn't it?
It's very difficult.
So Leah's nine, but she would have been seven.
Then she was, yeah.
Holly was only three, and Hannah was only, you know, well, she wasn't even
she
talking
was two,
at that
yeah.
stage.
Yeah, she was. So we just basically, we were always honest with Leah. As he was getting worse, she would ask a lot of questions. And then when we knew, you know, he was getting bad, we had to sit Leah down and say, the medicine that they're giving Daddy isn't working, and that Daddy's going to die. And it was, I think, the worst moment of my life. She just roared. Like, she didn't even cry. She screamed. I've never heard it before. And we were all very upset. And then Daniel slept with her that night, and she clung to him. I actually have photographs. She wouldn't let him go. Very difficult.
Yeah.
But Rachel was to gain support from a perhaps slightly unusual source. Daniel had encouraged her to create an Instagram account where she could share her love of interior design and, as it happens, find a way to talk about her grief.
I have a bit of a passion for interior, so that's what it kind of started off as. And then I kind of mentioned on my story about Daniel, and then people start messaging in, and people were saying, you're really helping me. And so I came on to talk because people were asking me questions. So I didn't want to come on and talk on Instagram at all. I didn't think I would be able to. And now I'm sure they're sick of listening to me.
And what sort of questions were they asking you, Rachel?
They're asking me about treatment, what different chemos that they are,
yes, yeah.
That he was getting. The amount of people that say, you know, you're helping me. And I couldn't understand how I was helping somebody. But the messages coming in, the support, and it's really lovely to see. Now, look, you get an odd message here and there. That's not yeah. very nice. But for overall, like 99.9% of people are absolutely fantastic.
How could anybody possibly be mean to you?
Oh, it's brutal. So I had someone say to me once, you know, you're making your husband's illness out worse than it is. He's not sick at all, because one minute he's dying in hospital and the next minute you're laughing on your Instagram because yeah. I had put up a family photograph.
But that's life, isn't it?
That's life. You know, he died 2 weeks later.
People tell jokes at funerals.
And you know what? We laughed so much at his funeral. I know that's shocking to say, yeah. but we did. We told stories about him and we laughed and, you know, then we cried.
That's life.
That's life. That's grief. You know, that's...
Yeah.
And Rachel spoke about the very personal nature of grief.
There's no right way. Like, everybody grieves differently. But I had someone message me saying, you know, you're coming on here and with your crocodile tears, or you're coming on, you're laughing, your yeah. husband would be ashamed of you. And then I started to question, am I grieving right? Because I've never lost anyone, like, other than my grandparents. I've never lost anybody like this before.
That close
so
to you, yeah.
I started to question myself, like, am I grieving right? Am I doing the right things? But you have to try and not let them get into your head, you know,
yes,
that
yeah.
I'm doing the best I can. I'm doing the best for my kids.
So how often now are you visiting his grave?
I go up every day or every second day, like if the rain is really bad. I used to say to him, I'm going to cremate you, because he wanted to be buried. And I said, I'm going to cremate you. I'm not standing up at a graveyard in the rain. And we'd laugh and he'd say, I don't care if you don't go up. He said, I won't be there anyway. I'll be at home watching you. So sometimes I like to go up in the rain just to say, oh, look, I'm here for you and whatever. But I used to go up like twice a day and sit there for hours. And now I try and dwindle it down to once a day.
Rachel Gorry with Ray. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Saturday morning last, the news broke that football legend and honorary Irishman Jack Charlton had died. Among the many people who joined Brendan O'Connor to pay tribute to Jack was John Aldridge.
Jack went out looking for the players, didn't he? How did he recruit you?
From David Langan, a fullback at Oxford. Owen Hand was getting aware of the situation, and Owen unfortunately lost his job, and Jack came in and he came to watch me play in a semi-final of the League Cup, the Mill Cup at the time for Oxford, at Villa. And we drew 2-2, and I got the two goals, thankfully, and he came up to me after the game and asked me would I play for him and the Republic of Ireland, which I said I'd be delighted and honoured to, and shook his hand. And then the famous story from that is I pointed to Ray Outon, and he said, you know, Ray Outon over there? He said, yeah. And he said, well, his dad's from Donegal. He said, is he? So we made a beeline for Ray, and he got two for the price of one. He didn't know about Ray. We could write a book which people wouldn't believe about stories of Jack. He had such charisma, you know. He was passionate about loads of things, fishing, not more than fishing. And it was just the best 10 years of my life, on and off the pitches.
And the following day, Tony Cascarino joined Brendan to tell this story.
I think my favourite memory of Jack was when we went to the Curra Racing one particular day, and Jack had said, you can have a few beers. It was a build-up to World Cup 1990, and he said, you can have a few beers today, lads, but don't go too far. So, of course, we watched the racing, had a few beers, and then half past five, we were leaving and the coach to go back to the hotel, and Jack got on the bus and we were sitting there and we all started singing, we love you, Jackie, we do, we love you, Jackie, we do. And as we was in that, he got on the microphone and said, I am not stopping at a pub and letting you lot have a more drink. We've got a World Cup qualifiers, World Cup campaign to play. And so we went, boo. He sat back down and we started singing, we love you, Jackie, we do. Went all for it again. He gets up on the mic and says, I tell you what, we can have a drink, but on one condition, I'm not buying a drink. And there we were that night, all celebrating together. And we just had an incredible relationship.
What an incredible story. Unless you think, hey, it's just football. Fiona Looney put those heady Italian 90 days in context.
It was a different Ireland. But it was a progression into the Ireland we have now. And I'm sure economists would argue it, but I don't think that we would be the country we are now if it hadn't been for the boys in green and if it hadn't been for Jack Charlton. You know, we grew up in an Ireland that was very repressed, very bleak. Almost from the beginning of the state, there was this notion in this country, know your place. You know your place and stay in your place. And I think that what Jack Charlton and the boys in green did was they taught us to find our place. And, you know, we were, for the first time ever, we were allowed to get notions. The one thing you're never allowed to have in this country. And we got notions. And they turned out to be good notions. And, you know, we went all the way to a World Cup quarterfinal. So I think we really, you know, it was an element of a kind of a rising tide, really lifting all the boats. But we just stood up a bit straighter. After that, I think, became this huge social movement. And, you know, like my father would have been absolutely dyed-in-the-wool GAA man, wouldn't have had an awful lot of time for soccer and certainly, you know, the Irish. Like he really wouldn't have had an awareness of the national team. And, you know, by the end of 1990, like, you know, his house was festooned in, you know, the cheapest possible bunting. And, you know, we were all watching the games there and jumping off couches. And, you know, so I think everyone from the very young to the very old just got behind this. And it was sort of, you didn't really question it at the time. You just went with it because it was such good fun. And it was so positive and so surrounded by wonder and excitement that, you know, nobody, it's only now we kind of look back and go, wow, we really changed during that time. We didn't know it at the time. I suppose we grew up.
Fiona Looney with Brendan O'Connor, and Sunday Sport brought us this.
Not easy. Onto it comes Houghton. And Houghton with the shot. And it's there!
They made me an honorary Irishman, which was very nice. And since then, I've had a really lovely relationship with the Irish people. We've worked hard. We've covered miles and miles of ground. We've produced a team that the Irish can be proud of and that they like to watch. The Southern Irish people are very nice. They're very good people. And maybe it's because I've pleased them and done well that I'm accepted over there now.
The late Jack Charlton, as heard on Sunday Sport. Over on the Mooney Goes Wild Seabird Special on Sunday evening, birds of the smelly variety were getting up the nose of ornithologist Niall Hatch.
Oh, there are those waves again and all those birds on the seabird colony. And I thought, Niall, at this stage, it's probably a good point to explain exactly what a seabird colony is.
Well, good point, Derek, absolutely. We normally talk about birds when they're nesting as being very territorial. They like to have their own patch where they keep other birds away. Seabirds are different. Seabirds, or most species at least, nest in colonial groups. So they do have a territory, but that territory may be only a few inches wide and a ledge on a cliff, or maybe a burrow at the top of a sea stack. And there's safety in numbers, you see. That's why the seabirds nest together in these big colonies. You can hear the sounds there in the background there. That's very evocative to me. I've spent my life visiting seabird colonies. I absolutely love it. You picture the scene, though, the birds just milling all over the place, coming in with fish for their young, squabbling with each other, fighting for space. The thing, though, that's very hard to convey, though, is the smell. There's a very distinctive smell in seabird colonies.
Brought it with you.
Thank you very much, Derek. Absolutely. I tried to share, but it was rushed. But no, absolutely. What happens is that they eat a lot of fish.
Fish, of
and
course.
When you go there, you see this guano everywhere, the bird droppings, which itself has a very pungent odour of fish. So when you go there, the smell, it can take a few minutes to get used to it, and then finally you become accustomed to it, you kind of tune it out. But it's a really multi-sensory experience. You have the sights and the sounds and the smells. There's nothing like it. And here in Ireland, we are privileged to have so many of these colonies on our doorsteps. It's wonderful.
Aside from the unholy stink, that is, that was Mooney Goes Wild on Sunday. And speaking of the pungent odours of fish, Ray Darcy was cooking up a storm in studio.
I don't know how we're going to get the smell of fish out of this studio. Ryan Turner will be given out in the morning. Who was eating fish in this studio? It was me, Ryan. It was me.
It's 4 minutes past nine. We're here till 10. The text number 51551. The reason I took that little, because the somebody's cutting the grass outside and it's coming through the pipes and it smells gorgeous. So I just had a little, almost like a lecter-esque, but in a nice way. You like with the grass that's freshly cut. Okay, the email.
Ooh, well played, Darcy. Didn't suspect a thing, and him off in his halls. But there were more smells on the airwaves this week when musician Caoimhe Reardon came into Sean Roxon Arena to pay homage to the music and writing of Patti Smith. But it didn't start off as a love affair.
You didn't begin too well with Patti Smith, it has to be said, did you? You know?
It's so funny that I was invited in to talk about Patti because I hated her. When I was a teenager, I was born in 65. So when I first started paying attention to what was happening outside of, say, the Wombles or the Glitter Band and Slade, she'd gone through the Horses era and she was at the Easter era, which would be her third album, which had an album cover of her basically sniffing her armpit and the hairs all out. And to me, at 13, she just looked like all the smelly hippies who had upset me when I was growing up. That's the big, my Proustian olfactory memory is smelly hippies. So I just said, nope, no, nuh-uh, don't want anything to do with Patti Smith. And I just ignored her.
Purely on the basis of smell.
Purely on the basis that the way she looked reminded me of smelly hippies.
But then along came the Patti Smith memoir, Just Kids, and her 1975 album, Horses.
All along, all artists I liked have been saying, Horses, what's your favourite album? Horses, you know, who's your favourite woman musician? Patti Smith, have you heard Horses? And so I was like, okay, I have to listen to Horses.
I better start with Horses.
Oh, I better, yeah, because everyone...
Which was her debut album.
It was her debut album.
And the opening track on that album contained this opening line.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine.
And you were saying, as we listened to that, the song was released, well, the album was released in 1975, but she wrote that poem, or those words were written back when she was 20, which we worked out somewhere in the mid to late 60s.
Yeah, she was born in 46, and I read somewhere she said she was 20, because of course people have always asked her, what did you mean by that? What were you saying? What was this huge declaration you made? She says, well, I was 20 when I wrote that. And it was part of this poem that she started performing when she was 70 as a spoken word, in 1970 as a spoken word piece. But I've read different things that she said about it. She said that thing, well, I was 20 and I don't even know what it meant. I just wanted to kind of say I'm free of Jesus. I didn't want Jesus worrying about me. And then later she said things like she was raised a Jehovah's Witness by her mother, but her dad was a rebel and her dad would blaspheme and swear about God. And she said, I definitely got it from him. It was just something that I wanted to say, Jesus, you don't have to look out for me. I'll look out for myself. And again, what a fantastic thing for a young person to say. But in the context, Sean,
in the context
of America, which is still incredibly conservative. Whoa. The balls on that woman.
Indeed, that was Culture Reardon on Patti Smith as heard on Arena. And that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine. Milton, pot of thieves, wild cord on my sleeve, thick heart of stone, my sins my own, they belong to me, me. People say beware, but I don't care, the words are just rules and regulations to me. Me, I walk in a room, you know I look so proud. I'm moving this year's more fear, where anything's allowed. I'll go to this here party. Here she comes.